Fred Copeman, reel 8.
Who was it who was for Jock Cunningham and who was against?
All of the guy's people, except Williams. Anyway, the stamp committee was...
Like you were telling me about Jock Cunningham and the central committee.
Yeah. I think the whole business was a political decision to withdraw the top cadres of the party, that they'd come to the conclusion that the war wasn't going to last much longer, that they couldn't get recruits, and therefore the people they wanted to remain with the party would stay behind. Now, Jock was a bit of a problem. Jock didn't get on with Harry Pollitt, by the way. Harry Pollitt literally worshipped Fred Copeman. He was the boy for Harry, you know what I mean? Everything, I couldn't do anything wrong where Harry Pollitt was concerned. And when I took over the battalion, he came out and said, Fred, you know, this is the most wonderful thing for the party point of view. I said, I can't see how it should be because I'm not in a bloody party. See, I hadn't joined the party, you know. I'd always worked with them. Well, I didn't hold a party card. But Harry thought I was a bee's knees. And he was quite happy about that. And I have a feeling that Harry was so anxious to build me up for the future that the danger he saw was Jock Cunningham, who was already more important than I was. He was a good lad, you know. And I accepted that. I thought Jock was the best. Anyway, the end product was, Harry got up and said, well, the only people who have expressed a point of view as to what is happening to the battalion at this moment, that they're out there and we're here, what are we going to do about it, has been Fred Copeman and Wally Tapsell. And therefore, my proposal is that they return to Spain and everybody else remain where they are and now start to build up political support for the dependents, because there's no longer any recruitment possible. Things had tightened up on getting people across France. The French government were no longer cooperating. Everybody was on this non-intervention business, you see. So that was it. I had my thoughts. I told you that the first thing that came into my mind was, look, we're the two loons that they want to get rid of. Because I wasn't a politician. I've never been a party politician. I've always been even here in Lewisham when I stood for Parliament, it was quite out of this world, you know. You never saw anything like it. We swamped this bloody Tory who had a 15,000 majority, had a swing against Labour, and we still only lost by 90 votes because it was one of those things. The crowds turned up. They liked what they heard. They liked the company I kept. I had some good people come here, you know. The Nye Bevans, the best of the Labour came. That old Fred and the people in instinctively see what's going on, you know.
How did Jock Cunningham respond to this personal
Jock
attack?
Just broke down. Never seen anything like it. I tried to help him out, but it was no bloody good. I said, look, Jock, it'll be all right. This will all work out. They won't be able to swamp the battalion. When the lads come back, they'll tell their story. And things were from then onwards by the hour, you know. You were 1 minute, you're in central committee room, and the next, we were away, on our way back. I insisted on getting a proper political document, you know, to establish authority, which I got. Which made me quite a big shot with that bit of paper. You'd be surprised what happens with stamps from the Central Committee in the communist movement internationally among the top people. How they do it, I don't know, but there is a method which I wouldn't necessarily understand, but anybody reading that bit of paper would know this is it, you see. Another bit of paper looking the same would produce nothing. This one produced the goods, and Harry did his stuff for me, all right. We arrived back, we took another crowd with us, another 400 and something. This was the last lot.
Before you talk about going back, going back, I'm still thinking of Brunetti, actually. It seems to me that the energy of the battalion, of the whole brigade, was diffused among the villagers. Why didn't you just keep pushing ahead instead of going off to concentrating on all the individual villages?
Well, that wasn't my problem.
No, I know that wasn't for you to say.
Well, you see, there weren't any other villages. Once we passed Villeneuve de Canard, it was all open country up to the hill. You could see place in addition, but they weren't in our sector. It's all open country. You had to take the top of that bloody hill. That was the thing. It was the only thing that stood out for miles around, and it was to the west of Madrid, and that was the important military objective. Everybody else was spreading the front to give that hill a support once it was taken. That was the whole idea. Not much point sticking out. It had to go forward on a front. There were other brigades would have villages to take and places like that, but certainly not us. There's not a bloody building between Villeneuve and where we were, and we couldn't see anybody within sight either. Except, of course, the peasant battalion, bandits, they were taking villages and places, but that was towards Toledo, you know, well to our right, right out of our sector altogether. No, that what happened was bloody obvious. First, the ammunition, that was a key thing. When that ammunition dump blew up, the 15th Brigade had had it. They only had the ammunition that they were carrying. And we were in the same boat as everybody else. The time came when we didn't have any rifle ammunition. We even had to depend on the anti-tank guns, which were well behind us, to fire a few rounds every so often to let them know we were around, you know what I mean? No, that was the one key thing, whether that was an accident or part of the usual thing. You see, you have a victory and then you come back to where you started. And that surely happened at Brunetti. We returned pretty well. We kept Villeneuve, I think. Lost Brunetti. Franco simply blew the bloody place up when he got it for punishment because they gave up without a fight. And some of the destruction of Brunetti is still there to this day. Deliberately left there by Franco as a, you know, example of what happens to people who don't fight for him. No, when I got back, I was on a brigade headquarters. And Wally
Tapp. You had an anti-tank battery. Was this a unit led by Malcolm Dunbar?
Yes, that's it. All students. Picked by me. I had an idea. Yeah, little girl. And things you say can be embarrassing, but they're facts of life. I have a mania for fitness. A fit man is a tough man. And therefore anything that affects fitness to me is something I don't want any part of, as if it's detrimental to fitness. Good-looking students are a bloody problem. I'm not going to run away from it. I know they're a problem. People hide it, but they're there. So my attitude, first, they got on well together. Secondly, they were a bit of a bloody problem. Third, they were intellectuals, and they tended to discuss with each other and not with the mass of blokes. And therefore, if they're going to do a job, why not give them a job? They'll like, they'll be together. They'll talk much higher intellectually than us. If they've got any problems, then they'll sort them out among their bloody selves. But it won't affect my blokes. But I'll still have charge of them. So the best looking one of the lot was Malcolm Dunbar, so I put him in charge. There was another lad, deputy him, that wrote a book, by the way. It was made into a film. Went on dope, became an addict, died of it. Met them long after with Charlotte Haldane, after we got back, or in fact after the war. What was his name now? Bloody book that the film was a star was Taylor in it. It was a bit of a hot one too.
Why were these students a problem? You mean they were homosexuals?
No, but they were too good looking, you know, for me. I know If you get a good-looking lad among 20 big, husky, bloody men, well, he's going to turn that way whether he likes it or no. That's what life's all about when they're on their own. You can't stop it. Men have got to have some expression. You're no good saying you can't have any sex. It's bloody ridiculous. They'll find their own bloody sex. That's why we let them go to Madrid, 25 at a time. You've got to do that. You've got to cater for men. Navy caters for bloody men. You go ashore. When they don't want them to go with women, they take them to bloody Greek island somewhere where you run around rocks with pieces of paper chasing, or long distance races and rowing and anything but women. But when they want to have a good time, they take them to Nice and around the bloody French coast, the Italian coast, and you have a good time. Everybody knows they're having a good time. The doctors have more to do, but that's about all. The lads like it, of course. And therefore, there is a problem. Any military commander's got to take that into account. And my sailor's mind happened to work a different way to other people. But it worked. That's the main damn thing, because they were good, you know. This anti-tank company was bloody good.
What kind of equipment did they have?
They had three small Russian anti-tank guns. Beautiful little things. That really did their stuff. They didn't have a range of more than, a mile and a half. Could go further, but a mile and a half is about enough. But at 700 yards, 800 yards, 1,000 yards, my God, they were there. You could pinpoint a machine gun, they'd blow that out of the ground in no time. And they were intellectual. They could work out there's a certain amount of intellect required in ranging a gun, you know, which you give to fellas who they can practice with, and they liked them, they looked after the guns, and they used them on whatever they were ordered to do. They were always there. And they had plenty of courage, you know, they weren't dodgers. They just happened to be intellectuals who, in my opinion, had a job to do and could do it better among themselves, and just lost among a bunch of roughnecks. And that's why they were there. And I think they themselves, if you met any of them, would agree. I read a book here the other day, and that surprises me. I'll tell you this. In that book, The International Brigade, I've just read, written by Boom, is it, or some name like that, he says that Malcolm Dunbar was a homosexual. Well, I didn't know that. These blokes that came to see me about Alan Foote said, was Alan Foote a homosexual? I said, what the hell makes you think he was a homosexual? You wouldn't have got far if you'd have said that to him. They knocked your bloody head off. He said, well, of course, we're in that both ways. I said, well, I didn't know. He certainly wasn't when I was around. Although I'm not naive enough to say there wasn't plenty of that. There's plenty of it in the Navy. You can take it from me. Certainly in my bloody time, no boy in the Navy was allowed to sleep on his bloody own. If he did, he was the most amazing bloody thing the world had ever seen. He had to get himself what they called an old man, and he was a winger, or everybody in a bloody ship like that type of thing chased him. And sooner or later, he'd have to give way. I mean, that's how life is. You have 1,000 men together, and there are 20 boys. They're not going to be left alone, you know. Society might tell a thing. I could tell you a name, mate, that's been held up in this country as the greatest. He's got more medals than anybody else. And what is perfect. Good fellow, I'll give you that. I'm telling you, he liked the boys. He liked the women, too. But then that's his bloody problem. I'm not going to judge him. Life's that way. We're bloody hypocrites, if we say it. But I know it happened. But I tell you, you don't inspect the line of trenches and every 10 feet is a bloody French letter and there's no women in the bloody battalion. Well, they're being used on something, you know. Not holes in a bloody bank, are they? As simple as that. And if you know blokes have got dugouts and you see one good-looking lad and four ugly baggers, well, that's life. I'm not going to say, look, lad, you're having it off. That's his business, as long as you fight. But tell him, you know, when there's a battle on, we're alone. It's there.
I think the popular sort of romantic view of Spanish Civil War has practically everyone who was there being an intellectual or a student. But this anti-tank battery is the first time you've mentioned intellectuals being with you.
Mm. Oh, there were plenty. In the early days, of course, the majority were students. But, of course, the recruits I recruited weren't students at all. There might have been a few. But most of them were ordinary working class lads. Lads who I'd known hunger marts and things like that. The younger ones, because we handpicked them because we needed young ones, didn't need old men. But the idea that they must know, somebody would know whether he was or whether he wasn't. My own attitude is I couldn't care any less. Doesn't mean a bloody thing to me. Because all my life I've lived with boys and men until I got married. So if anyone wants to tell me what happens with men who on the surface are all brave English sailors, and I know what happens in a bloody sugar hold. I know what happens when there's a mate of men who sleeps with who. Two blokes don't sleep together in a bloody dark corner because they like a dark corner, because they like each other. But no one goes shouting the bloody world about it. It just happens that way. Part of life. And that's how it will always be, and always has been. And I'm not against those people who... I would not myself denigrate any religion. The Spanish Civil War made me respect religion. Certainly respect people with a faith. You see, the priests that came up were not people sent up. These were priests who were sincere people who wanted their faith in right there in the troops and came and took a chance on their life just the same as to their own Spanish people. And they were good people. And I found out when I joined the Catholic Church they were even more bloody good people. But I just couldn't swallow the fact that the church always seemed to be where there was agony and poverty and riches, you know what I mean? The two things didn't go together. And when I sit and think and read, and this lad that wrote the poem that got put up for whatever you call it, you know, denigrating Christ. After all, intelligent people. Why would 12 or 16 men live together? No women? Why shouldn't somebody assume that there was something among them? It might have been one, but in not to assume that they were completely opposite to everything else that happened in life, because everywhere else where men are alone, there is that. Why shouldn't it be there? So if we're going to be truthful, if it's so deeply felt, then face the fact that there was a possibility. The trouble is that society in our part of the world, for its own reasons, makes that a problem. There are parts of the world where it's part of their religion. You would never dream of thinking anything wrong with it. And I've been in the world, you see, I've been a lucky old fellow in all around the world. I've been into the Mohammedan countries, and I know what happens to the little boys in the temples and all that kind of business. You have to be on a old tripe to hide it.
I've been thinking about war in the Washington Battalion. As a black officer, did he have any trouble with the white troops?
I don't think so. That's what surprised me. Well, they liked him. He certainly had their respect. They didn't get a chance to show themselves, you see. They had no sooner in the line and they were literally decimated in a few minutes. And the remainder then joined after helping us. And that was the amazing thing about these Yanks. I didn't show a lot of friendship to Americans. I've got a kind of attitude to Yanks that they yap too much and they got too much money. And, you know, there's this natural instinct now, to hell with you. So we weren't great friends. We got on all right. But nothing to shout about. But Wall, with his about 30 fellas, gave the remainder of their time to get food up to us, which was about the most difficult problem anybody would take on, and certainly the most costly in lives. Not many of those lads came out. All of those nearly got killed on that slope, trying to get bloody tins of soup up onto our hill. When you look back on it, a bloke like Montgomery would study the Battle of Brunetti and say, what a lot of codswallop. Here they had these lovely lorries, hundreds of new lorries. Why didn't they stay in the bloody thing and just drive up the hill and get off? Because there was nothing to stop them except that one village. They'd gone by it and left it and then come back and sorted it out in their own time, but they didn't. They spent all their energy on that one fortified village. That's as far as the 15th Brigade was concerned. But the others did the same. There were other 45 places where the Campesino division got held up, never took the bloody place, never got any further. That's why the thing didn't really succeed. Mind you, the ammunition problem was the key to it. When you look back, the Spanish Civil War and all the heroism and the thousands that died, the facts are that ammunition was supplied at a certain time for a certain time and then was stopped. And it always coincided with a victory for the Republic. The Republic won every bloody battle, but never won a victory. Even Guadalajara. Guadalajara is one of the finest things that ever happened. They did the reserve for the Italians. They let them run towards Madrid for 7 days, and then they all ran back for 7 days. And the main reason was the silly bloody Italians didn't have the ammunition either at the right moment. And our people, for once, were doing the opposite. But it didn't gain anything from it. In the end, they retreated back to where they started, you know, because the old ammunition problem once again affected us. It's a horrible thing. And, of course, those who at the time said, look, this is bloody awful, and fought it, and I was one of them. I gave up my bloody political career with the party because I wouldn't stand for this bloody Russian dominance of everything. When I went to Russia, I didn't hide, I didn't like them. I had already been biased in Spain. There were too many bastards running around giving orders and not enough of them fighting. And those that were giving orders, they were ruthless, silly orders. An irresponsibility to human life. And behind it, not with the fighting people, but with the politicians, this ruthless serving out of so much and no more. Having the eye to the future, the big war that was coming, and who should fight who. The idea that for the Republic to win, and for the Russians to support them, and the major war starting, the British, Gibraltar, would be like a red flag to a bull, and to have a red government behind Gibraltar, why the hell are they going to support? They'll fight the bloody Russians, of course they will. And therefore the Russian had to be sure that that didn't happen. The route through the Mediterranean in a major war was a colossal thing. Spanish Civil War was just a bloody punch-up in the backyard in comparison. Therefore, looking at it in that light, they did the right thing. After all, at the end of the road, the thing, who won, who didn't? The bloody Russians had the right people on their side. They did finally win with those people. And not only that, they carved those people up and they got everything they wanted out of them. Biggest part of Europe. Now, what better success can you have of that? If we're going to rely on the old British sportsmanship and fair play. A bit bloody daft, isn't it, if you're going to lose a major war through fair play. We like to say that, but because now I look back, I see all the things I got hurt about in the Spanish Civil War were in themselves inevitable. It was inevitable. We did our best because we were carried away with an ideal, which was a good one. If the world lived on those ideals, we'll finally finish up with no wars. But I'm afraid they're not going to go that way. The stronger science becomes and the more terrible the things they produce, the more guarantee there is that the world will slaughter its bloody self. And we shall finish up with some funny little people up the Amazon, or in the middle of Africa, the only ones left alive. And we'll have to start all over again from there. And all us brilliant bloody industrial nations will be just a mass of bloody cinders. Yes, it's almost inevitable. And we see it now. Look at this business now. The bloody National Front are doing it. You don't hear the British Communist Party, do you? You never hear the British Communist Party in relation to the National Front. You hear the Trotskyists and you hear every otherist but the Communists. They become more bloody Tory than the Tories. If you look at this present position, exactly the same thing's happening as during the Spanish Civil War. They are preparing for something much bigger.